From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, there's a surprising and true story at the summer box office, and it has nothing to do with rampaging dinosaurs, animated crime fighters, or any Marvel character. Then jazz musician Terrence Blanchard has been composing music for Spike Lee movies going back decades. His next film with the director is Black Klansman.
It's about us coming together to make a powerful statement to hopefully inspire and motivate people to get off the sideline and get involved in moving this country forward.
All that coming right up. The summer movie season, as usual, is overflowing with stories about superheroes, those who must carry the comic book burden that with great power comes great responsibility. And one of the most popular superheroes of this summer is probably one of its most surprising.
I surely would not be in this room today without the determined efforts of men and women who kept dreams of equal citizenship alive.
Yes, that is Associate Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The 85-year-old Ginsburg is the subject of the documentary RBG, and along with one other nonfiction film, RBG has been one of the most notable box office hits of the summer movie season. Following its opening in early May, RBG has grossed more than $11 million at the domestic box office, making it one of the highest-grossing independent releases of the year. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg isn't the only person who was born before World War II who is attracting a big crowd at the multiplex. There's also this guy.
Love is at the root of everything. All learning, all parenting, all relationships. Love or the lack of it.
That's Fred Rogers, the creator and host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. The life of Rogers and the history of his educational TV series is at the center of the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor. Just like RBG, it's also been a huge hit at the box office. In less than a month in theaters, the Fred Rogers film has grossed more than $7.5 million and should soon pass RBG for total ticket sales. Both RBG and Won't You Be My Neighbor received great notices from film critics. Neither has a Rotten Tomatoes score lower than 93. But there's more to the film's performances than positive reviews. The documentaries also seem to be connecting on a personal, emotional level with audiences of all ages. At a time when the country feels terribly polarized, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Fred Rogers represent, through their work and their legacies, the ideal that we are born equal, not separate. Ginsburg faced a tremendous amount of discrimination as a woman who wanted to become a lawyer. As a law student at Harvard, she was barred from entering its law library solely on the basis of her gender. In an era of Me Too, where the true nature and perils of a patriarchy are constantly being revealed, RBG speaks to women of all generations. And it's also important that Ginsburg persevered and succeeded against all odds. Here's Betsy West, the co-director of RBG.
She talked to us about the lesson that she learned from her mother at a very early age, was anger is a waste of time. And I think by that she means not that she wouldn't get angry, but that she would move beyond it and try to figure out a way around it. And in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's case, after she was discriminated against and kept out of jobs and denied an opportunity to be a clerk on the Supreme Court because she had been recommended to a justice on the Supreme Court who said, I'm not going to hire a woman. Within a decade of all the discrimination that she faced, she was part of this movement to change the discriminatory laws and customs in our country. And ultimately, she brought a series of lawsuits that really did force the Supreme Court to look at this discrimination that was out there that people really didn't recognize as discrimination. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg brought it to their attention and had a tremendous impact on every woman in this country.
While Ginsburg has been a champion of women, Fred Rogers, you could say, was a champion of humanity. Given the fierce debate the nation is having about breaking up the parents and children of immigrants entering the nation illegally, Fred Rogers spoke to the importance of family and looking after the less fortunate. As a Presbyterian priest, Rogers saw his TV show as a ministry, and the stories he told to children were often parables about compassion and reconciliation. At a time when African Americans were barred from swimming in the same pools as Caucasians, Rogers, in one episode, invited a black man who played a police officer in his neighborhood to share a wading pool. Against today's rise of white nationalism and the fear of others, his message is still essential. Many people who've seen the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, have said that it's brought them to tears. Here's the film's director, Morgan Neville.
The film still gets me emotional. Even as we were finishing the film and watching it back again and again, we kept getting emotional watching it. And I think part of it is that those of us who grew up with him had a connection with him that predates almost anything else in our life. You know, next to our family members, it's probably the oldest relationship we have. And there's something about spending time with him that asks us to revisit a part of ourselves we haven't visited in a very, very long time. Our own, I guess you could call it inner child. But there's something about the directness with which he speaks. He had that laser focus in his way of cutting through all the adult filters and shields and getting right to the core of what it is. And the experience to me of watching the film is finally you have to kind of succumb to his directness. You kind of have to give in and say, okay, I'm willing to be emotionally open as you are. You know, I'm willing to be vulnerable, because Fred was incredibly vulnerable always. And I think you finally have to kind of meet him on those grounds, because he would have it no other way. He always made you come to him.
RBG and Won't You Be My Neighbor are in theaters now. And I'll add that by summer's end, the documentary Three Identical Strangers could also outpace both of those films for very different reasons. And now, trumpeter Terrence Blanchard is well known for playing with Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers and the Lionel Hampton Orchestra, but the New Orleans native is also a prolific film score composer. He scored the upcoming Spike Lee movie Black Klansman. Here's a cut from the film's trailer where a black police officer imitates a white guy calling the head of the KKK.
Hello, this is Ron Stallworth calling.
Who am I speaking with?
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
God. Last time I checked. What can I do for you?
Well,
since you asked, I hate blacks. I hate Jews.
Mexicans and Irish. Italians and Chinese.
But my mouth to God's ears, I really hate those black rats. And anyone else, really, that doesn't have pure white Aryan blood running through their veins.
Black Klansman, which opens next month, is the most recent collaboration with Spike Lee. He has scored many of Lee's movies, narrative films, including Jungle Fever and Malcolm X, and his HBO documentary about Hurricane Katrina, When the Levees Broke, a story that hit Blanchard personally. I recently connected with Blanchard from his home studio in New Orleans, and we started with what he learned from his mentor, the jazz percussionist and bandleader Art Blakey.
Right when I left the band, I used to tell people all the time, I played with him for 4 years, but I felt like I aged by 40, because I was meeting all of my heroes, and playing with him every night is something that you can't train for, or you can't even teach. Watching him shape the compositions that we had written for the band was an eye-opening experience. And the life lessons, I can't even begin to tell you about those. My kids get tired of me talking about Art Blakey, man, because, you know, I said, well, you know, Art always used to tell us blah, 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 blah. And they're like, Jesus Christ, can we find somebody else to talk about?
The one thing that I think is really interesting about Art Blakey's music is not only is it incredibly proficient, but it also tells a story. There's an emotional depth to his music that seems that it might have really kind of set you up for your work that you did soon after working with him, and that is playing music on film scores. How did you make your entrance into doing film scores? Where was your first collaboration, and what was that process like of writing for film as opposed to writing music that wasn't accompanying some sort of picture?
Well, I started writing film music when I started working with Spike just as a session player. They had this idea, I think, when they were doing school days, to bring in some young and older musicians together to create a unique sound. And we'd taken a break, and I started to sit down at the piano and started to play something that I was working on. Spike heard it and asked me if he could use it, and then asked me to write a string arrangement for it. And that's how my film career started with him, because he told me, you have a future in this business. And I thought he was just trying to egg me on, but he actually started hiring me. The difference between, you know, writing music for film and writing music for my own situation is that for film, I'm helping someone else tell their story and trying to tell it through the lens of the director. For example, years ago when we were doing Crooklyn, there was a scene in Crooklyn where this little girl had gone on the summer vacation and she was reading a letter that her mother had sent to her. And in the letter, there's all of the action that's happening in the neighborhood. So I scored the action of the neighborhood while she was reading the letter. And Spike said, no, go back. We want to stick with the sentiment of the letter, not the action of the film. And that goes back to what I was saying about telling the story through the lens of the director. Now, when it comes time for me to write music for my own situation, well, you know, that's just basically how I want to tell my own story.
Well, I want to ask you about doing music for something that is both a situation and is a film. It's the 2006 TV series with Spike Lee called When the Levees Broke. It's about the storm, Hurricane Katrina. Let's hear a little bit of music from that. There is a beauty to that music, and yet it's about a very sad and tragic event. How do you go about figuring out a theme for a story like Hurricane Katrina and what the music's going to do in helping tell that story?
The main thing about any of that is to try to get inside the soul of the people involved in the story. And that particular documentary wasn't hard because I was one of the persons involved in the story. You have to remember, it was an unimaginable moment in our history to think that an entire city could be underwater. I'm still in disbelief when I think about it. You know, I had a friend of mine who came here, I took him for a drive a couple of months after the hurricane, and I drove around the city for about an hour, and the only thing he said for the entire ride was, oh my God, the entire ride while he was taking pictures. That is what fuels me, humanity, the human experience, the human reaction. You know, a lot of people who had gone through that tragedy could never imagine losing their home in such a fashion. I didn't try to write New Orleans music. What I wanted to do with the score is to make it a universal story that everybody could relate to.
Now, Spike Lee, a lot of people would agree, he is sometimes going to hit you over the head a little bit. He has got a point, and he's going to make his point pretty clearly. When you're working with a director who has a very strong point of view, does that mean that you can't be overly dramatic or bombastic because he's going to be doing a lot of the screaming in the film as a filmmaker?
It depends on the film, and it depends on the scene. Some scenes I may go counter to what you see on the screen. Oh, actually, I can give you an example. Another example is in Miracle at St. Anna. One of the opening battle scenes, I scored the action. I was all geeked up to write some music for a World War II movie. And man, next thing you know, Spike comes back and he says, no. You know, we want to do this the other way. So I realized he wanted to show the heroism of the soldiers. So it depends. And it really depends on how it is we want to tell a story and at what point of the story does the film need, you know, the music to take over.
You recently worked with Spike Lee on the film Black Klansman. It's a period film, and it comes out later this summer. And Spike Lee made a powerful speech at the Cannes Film Festival recently, calling out the president for not condemning white supremacy after Charlottesville. That film is obviously incredibly timely, given its subject matter. How do you approach the music for that film? What was your approach in writing the score for Black Klansman?
Well, the thing, again, is like we all know what's right and wrong. We know that when you have a president that will not condemn white supremacy, what that dog whistle means. So the music is there to be the glue, to kind of bring all of these elements together, but be the voice of reason as well, to be that element that hopefully will change some hearts and minds. For me, while I've been working with Spike, it's not just about making movies, man, with him, you know, because he tells powerful stories and he deals with tough issues. So for me, it's about us together, coming together to make a powerful statement to hopefully inspire and motivate people to get off the sideline and get involved, you know, in moving this country forward.
When we talk in Hollywood about the people who get to write film music, it's invariably almost always men, and it's invariably almost white men. Do you see the world of film scoring broadening, that it might be able to include more women and people of color in the years ahead?
No. It should. But is it? No. There's always going to be independent films and smaller budget productions that take a chance on people because that's just the nature of that. But when it comes to the big projects, it's a different animal, it's a different beast, and people are always scared to death to try something new, you know. But with the success of Black Panther, you would think that people would start to open their minds up to say, okay, listen, these guys made a lot of money and they did something extremely well. So we need to broaden our thinking, not only just from a film composer's standpoint, but from a filmmaker's standpoint. We have more women who are making films, obviously, but we need to have a broader, diverse group of people scoring them as well, I think, just to create something new and bring something different to the table.
Coming up, Terrence Blanchard talks about writing music for his jazz ensemble, The E Collective, and their album Live, which was recorded in communities marked by gun violence.
KPCC supporters include Center Theater Group, presenting The Humans, Stephen Karam's 2016 Tony Award winner for Best Play. Charles McNulty of the Los Angeles Times said, "The Humans has come to L.A. at full strength. If there's a better ensemble working in America right now than the extraordinary cast of The Humans at the Amundsen Theater, I'm unaware of its existence. The Humans, featuring the original Broadway company, only at the Amundsen, now through July 29th. More information at AmundsenTheater.org.
Now let's get back to my conversation with composer and jazz trumpeter Terrence Blanchard. His latest album, Live, was recorded in cities around the United States that have been marked by gun violence, in Cleveland to commemorate Tamir Rice, in Falcon Heights for Philando Castile, and in Dallas for the double shooting of police officers Rogelio Santander and Crystal Almeida. We pick up with this song from Live. It's called Chaos, which Blanchard recorded in Falcon Heights. And we talk about what he hoped to accomplish by visiting these communities firsthand.
We wanted to create something that would help heal some souls, take away the frustrations, and try to have some civic engagement in all of the places. When we got to Minneapolis, man, that place was just it just floored me, you know, because I went to the elementary school where Philando Castile worked, and it caught me off guard, you know, because I gave a little presentation to the kids that were there. And when I looked out there, man, the kids looked like a Jackson Pollock painting. There were hues and colors from all different walks of life. One of the workers there, he told us, he said, Phil was just a sweet dude, man. And by him personalizing that statement really made it real to me.
And that's Philando Castile, correct?
Yes, yes. And we tried to do what we could to keep this story alive about gun violence in our country, you know, because it seems to come and go rather quickly with each event, and we tend to forget. And I think we need to hold our elected officials' feet to the fire on this issue, because it's not getting any better, you know. And I'm not just talking about unarmed black men being shot by police. I'm talking about gun violence in general. That's the reason why we went to Dallas, because the police were shot. And I got to tell you, though, you know, when we got to Cleveland, man, there was a guy who came up to me after the show, and, you know, he said this music sounded very angry. And he said, and then you told me what the music was about. And when you told us what the music was about, my next thought was, I need to rethink my position on gun control.
In listening to you talk, I can't help but think about the students who survived the Parkland shooting and how they have become ambassadors, not only for peace, but for rational gun laws. Do you think art and activism through art can be kind of like the same sort of ambassadorship that they are fulfilling, that the music that you're creating, the conversations that your music is starting, can in some ways complement the conversations that kids like the survivors of Parkland are sparking themselves?
Of course. You know, look in the black community. What is one of the pieces of music that we always sing? We Shall Overcome. You know, because that piece of music there had touched a nerve and hit on an issue very directly about the motivating force behind the movement of that time. And still, to this day, when I look at the kids from Parkland, man, I'm extremely proud of those kids. And we need to celebrate those kids because they are the shining example of what our educational system is supposed to be about. And when we look at our country and the history of our country, who has been the motivating force for change in our country throughout? Young people. So I think music, if music can play a role in that, I'm all for it. I'm going to be about it. So while I love what I do in terms of just being a musician and an artist, there's also a responsibility to being a human being and not shying away from tough subjects that are affecting our country in a very negative way. I mean, just look at the number of shootings that we've had in this country where young kids are being killed, you know, and you mean to tell me we can't do anything? That's just ludicrous.
I'm going to ask you a musical question. It feels like even though jazz and hip hop have always had kind of a fractured relationship, lately we're seeing a lot more jazz players performing on hip hop albums. Kamasi Washington played with Kendrick Lamar, and it feels like the two styles are becoming maybe a little bit more intertwined, not just musically, but also politically. Where do you see that relationship evolving? Is it a united front? Is there a limit to the partnership? Where do you think the next chapter is?
I think it's like anything else, man. I mean, there are different elements that jazz musicians have always used to create something unique. I mean, we had the Afro-Cuban thing at one time. We had Latin jazz at one time. John Coltrane brought in Eastern music into his sound. You know, so hip-hop and all of that stuff, there's no different. They're like-minded people, you know. It's a tool, man. It's a way of speaking. It's a language. It's a genre. You know, it's not the end all. It's just a way of coming together and hopefully creating something unique. Very much in a similar way to what me and Spike do, you know, with the films. You know, my background as a jazz musician brings a different approach to writing for orchestra, and he knows that. And that's one of the things he loves about what it is that I do.
And it sounds like you're not going to stop with jazz and film scoring. You're doing some sort of opera piece next. Is that right?
Yeah, I was commissioned to write another opera. My first opera was about Emil Griffith. It's called Champion, and I was commissioned by Opera Theatre St. Louis for the 2013 premiere of that. And the next opera is going to be based on Charles Blow's book, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, with Casey Lemons writing the libretto.
Terrence Blanchard is a composer and a really, really good trumpet player. His new album is called Live or Live, depending on your approach. And he just wrote the music for Black Klansman, Spike Lee's new film. Terrence, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. It's been a joy talking to you today.
That is it for today. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're trying to post there a little bit more. You could find us at The Frame. We're going to be taking the day off tomorrow to celebrate the 4th of July. So from all of us at The Frame to you, have a safe and sane holiday. I'm John Horn. We'll be back on Thursday.